Договор о Евразийском экономическом союзе подписан. Астана, 29 мая 2014 года.
Ninety-one years, 5 months, and 2 days ago, five men gathered in Moscow and approved a treaty forming a new union. A few days shy of 69 years later, that union, the Soviet Union, dissolved, leaving in its wake 15 independent states. And they've stayed independent for more than 2 decades. One day ago, three men gathered in Astana to form another union, the Eurasian Union of Russia, Belarus, and Kazakhstan. Russian President Vladimir Putin says the new grouping is designed to foster the free flow of people, goods, and capital and services. But coming in the wake of Moscow's annexation of Crimea, and against the backdrop of Russia's intervention in eastern Ukraine, suspicions abound that it is but another step in the restoration of the old empire. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me in the studio is somebody whose voice our listeners should be getting to know well by now. Mirkat Sharapjan is a senior correspondent and analyst with RFERL's Central Newsroom and former director of our Kazakh service. Welcome back, Mirkat. It's always great to have you on the podcast.
Well, thank you for having me here.
And also joining me in our studio in Prague, making her first but hopefully not last appearance in the podcast, is Natalia Chudikova, senior editor of RFERL's Ukrainian service and host of the program European Connect. Welcome, Natalia, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Brian. Thanks for the invitation.
And we're always glad to have you, and we'd like to have you in the future. And by tradition, those making the first appearance here on the podcast get the first question, so let's start with you. The signing of the Eurasian Union in Astana took place just days after Ukraine announced that it was, once and for all, leaving the Commonwealth of Independent States, or CIS, ironically an organization that it was scheduled to chair this year, even though the Ukrainian parliament has never formally ratified the CIS treaty, and Ukraine is never really a full member of the CIS, even though it signed hundreds of agreements in the context of this. Nevertheless, the symbolism of this was impossible to miss. Natalia, Putin appears to have won Crimea. He got his Eurasian Union, but he also appears to have lost Ukraine, or at least the hearts and minds of Ukrainians, perhaps forever. Would you agree, have the events of the past few months driven a permanent wedge between these two countries?
Well, I think the symbolism of the events is really spectacular, but it's coincidental that Ukrainians wanted to leave the CIS as long ago as in 2006. And I've looked up our broadcasts, and they said that after the Orange Revolution, they were trying to leave the organization and being very frustrated with it, saying that none of the suggestions of then-President Yushchenko were even considered by the organization. So there were lots of things that they were very unhappy about in this organization. But now it's a very interesting situation that in spite of the war, even though many Ukrainians and the majority of Ukrainians think that they are in the state of war with Russian state, about the same number, something like 60%, say that the Russians are a friendly nation.
Mm. That's it. So there's not really a wedge been driven between the peoples.
Not about the people, even though you see it, and when you talk to the people, you say they say that it's really difficult to talk to their Russian friends and family because they are more likely to believe the Putin's propaganda, the Russian television, than their friends and relatives in Ukraine. But still, people think that they can overcome it, and that it will that their Russian friends and family will come to sit their senses someday.
So if a wedge hasn't been driven between the peoples, has one been driven between the states irreconcilably, perhaps?
I'm not sure about irreconcilably. The expectation is that someday Russia will also become a democracy, and then it will be a normal state with which one can build normal kind of friendly and neighborly relations in the economic sense and in the political sense too. But at this point, it's very difficult to talk to the Russian counterparts, because what you hear is that the especially in the last several months, that the authorities in Kiev are the junta, that they're fascists and that sort of things. So people who live in Ukraine, who live in Kiev, and they understand what is happening, it's very difficult, of course, to overcome that kind of rhetoric.
Right. Margaret, how would you assess these two events? On one hand, we had the signing in Astana yesterday, and then in Ukraine leaving the CIS. I mean, everybody you talk to about Russia's attempts to restore an empire, everybody says this is going to be empty without Ukraine. And Ukraine's clearly not interested in this. How would you assess these two events?
I think we have to use some symbols here. It's very symbolic that the agreement or treaty about the establishment of so-called Eurasian Economic Union was signed in Astana. Mm-hmm. In the new capital of a former Soviet republic, independent Kazakhstan, which was the last among all the republics which announced its independence.
91, that's correct.
Yeah. After Russia announced its independence from the Soviet Union, actually.
So actually, Kazakhstan was the last Soviet republic.
Well, de facto, all republics separated not from Russia, but from Kazakhstan, actually. So... that's one thing. Another symbol why Ukraine is important here. Even during the Soviet time, Ukraine and Belarus, these two important countries, were represented in the UN separately from the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. And they are among founding countries
of the
UN.
Of the UN,
That's we have to take that into consideration.
And the Soviet Union, actually.
Yeah, and for the Soviet Union, too. That was my next thing, is there were four republics which established the Soviet Union in 1922. A Transcaucasus Republic, uniting Armenia, Georgia, and
Azerbaijan.
It was called Transcaucasus Federative Soviet Socialist Republic. Ukraine, Belarus, and Russian Federation, which comprised all those republics, and they were autonomous. So importance of Ukraine is huge, not only economically, mentally. Everybody knows, and not only in terms of how important and how more autonomy, I would say, more pseudo or semi-independence it had even within the Soviet Union. But also in minds of the Russians, the myth, the history taught in Russia, not only in Russia, in the former Soviet Union, told us that Kiev is the mother of all Russian cities, that Kiev is a Russian center. Mm-hmm. So Russia started from Kiev. Of course, they were never taught about the great Lithuanian kingdom. We never said that would taught that the part of Russian... territories, Novgorod and Moscow, especially Moscow, was together with the Golden Horde. And meanwhile, Kiev was a completely different story. That's why there was we were not taught that. But Russians, especially those who are not educated, don't have a high education, living like in Siberia, in Urals and elsewhere, they believe that this is Russian territory. Mm-hmm. Well, especially now when Putin all of a sudden remembered this Novorossiya, the old name. I just was watching it with a very interesting feeling. He says that this is Novorossiya, but he forgets the first part. It's Novorossiya. It's new Russia, meaning that it's not Russia. It's one thing. It's like in Xinjiang, in China. They call it Xinjiang, which means new frontier. This is a Chinese territory. How can it be Chinese territory if it's new frontier? Mm-hmm. That's one thing. The next thing is, how about Zhelta-Rossiya, Manchuria, which plays a huge role and played a huge role in Russian nationalist patriotism. We know all the songs on the hills of Manchuria. Russia paid a lot of, sacrificed a lot of lives and stuff, but now it's China.
Right.
You know, it's in the Russian cities like Harbin and other smaller right. cities around there. They're now part of China. So what I want to say, symbolically, Ukraine is more important than Georgia's Abkhazia and South Ossetia.
Yeah,
Ukraine is something without which this new empire will not.
No, it has almost an emotional significance to Russians like Kosovo has to Serbs in a lot of ways.
Yeah, even more. I think even more because this is – and I think without Ukraine, as you said, this new unit union will stay on the same level, probably not –
It's going to be an organization on paper, I think, without Ukraine.
Yeah, we have this organization, not only CIS, we have an organization called Belarus Russian Union.
We all know how important that is.
And stuff. So I think this is a key point here. Ukraine, if it's not a part of CIS, it's not a part of Eurasian Economic Union, then... is going to be problematic for this union.
No, I've said this a million times in the podcast, but it merits repeating. I just can never forget these words that a Russian official said to me in the early 90s explaining the decision to break up the Soviet Union. And they said it was when Ukraine declared independence. Какой союз без Украины? There is no union without Ukraine. And this is, again, I was on the Armenian service program this morning. We were discussing this very issue and this very thing. Is this going to be just another organization on paper? And my feeling is without Ukraine, yeah, and Ukraine ain't joining. I don't see it happening.
No.
So along these lines, Natalia, do you have anything you wanted to add?
I just wanted to make a slight correction, but it's an important one. When Putin uses this term Novorossiya, he invents a new thing. He doesn't refer to the historical borders of the provinces which were called Novorossiya under the Tsarist, the Russian Empire. He includes Kharkiv Oblast and Donetsk and Luhansk areas which have never belonged there, and that's a way of a Russian manipulation with the historical facts and the way they use them for propaganda purposes. It's not that they cannot detach themselves from the Ukrainian past. They try to impose their view of the past on the Russians and on the Ukrainians too.
Exactly.
Along these lines, I wanted to play a clip from an interview I did back in February with Alexander Motil. He's a professor at Rutgers University, a well-known expert on Ukraine. Bear in mind, this happened before this crisis really escalated to the point it was now. This is back in February. Let's listen to Professor Motil.
For him to absorb Crimea is frankly a piece of cake. It wouldn't require any military aggression because the military is already based in Sevastopol and the Black Sea Fleet. All they need do is just leave the base and declare Crimea independent. Piece of cake. The problem is that for Putin, this would set a very unpleasant and potentially very dangerous precedent vis-a-vis his other non-Russian neighbors in the so-called near abroad. If Putin goes into Crimea, whether to liberate it, so to speak, or simply to annex it, he would effectively be declaring that Russia has the right to annex Russian-populated territories in the former Soviet Union. Once Putin declares that Russia has the unilateral right to go in and seize territories populated by Russians, he is essentially suggesting to all of these countries that they are in potential danger of a future annexation by the Russian Federation. This will undermine his efforts to ingather the non-Russian republics by means of his schemes, the so-called customs union, the so-called Eurasian Union.
Prophetic words, no? I did this interview back on, I checked the date, February 20th. That was 1 week before the little green man appeared for the first time. We didn't know what a little green man was when I did this interview, and we soon found out 7 days later when these beings were occupying buildings in Crimea, and now they're all over eastern Ukraine. And it was almost exactly 1 month before the formal annexation. Now, let's listen to a clip from an interview my colleague Robert Coulson did just this week on the eve of the Eurasian Union signing ceremony in Astana with the Minsk-based political analyst Yuri Chausov.
The Eurasian Union was previously viewed as just a platform for achieving compromises. But now, after the events in Ukraine, it is becoming clear that it's not just a common space for the movement of goods and services, but it might turn into a common space for the movement of little green men or polite people, or in general, a common space with a high potential for generating conflicts.
I absolutely love that quote. It was, you know, what is supposed to be a free space for the movement of goods and people is a free space, but for the movement of little green men, it's right on the mark, though. I mean, it really cuts to the heart of this. Markow, what do you think? I mean, have the events in Ukraine frightened countries like Kazakhstan and perhaps even Belarus away from closer integration with Russia? Even when that integration may benefit them, if it's just economic integration, has this frightened elites in these countries, even elites that may have been previously favorably predisposed towards Russia? Or conversely, on the other hand, has it made these countries more likely to do Moscow's bidding out of fear of a Ukrainian scenario? It could really work either way.
Of course, they are frightened. The events in Crimea, the events in eastern Ukraine, raised pro-Russian sentiments in large territories of Kazakhstan, in northern part, in northeastern part, especially northwestern part. And Nazarbayev, who is from that Soviet past, he fully understands.
He knows what's going on.
Yeah, and he knows that this kind of thing can happen in Kazakhstan in 24 hours. And, you know, in many places in Kazakhstan, it's not even necessary to bring green people there, green small. They're already there. You know, even though Kazakhstan prohibits dual citizenships, there's so many Kazakhstanis who still keep Russian citizenship and Kazakh citizenship. And I'm not saying about everybody. There are people who consider themselves as a part of a new nation called Kazakhstanis and stuff, but still, many Russian-speaking citizens of Kazakhstan, of Slav origin, they still see, if not their own, but the future of their own people, their own children and grandchildren in Russia, not in Kazakhstan. And that's why I know many people myself, my former classmates, my friends, their children are living in Russia. As soon as they're 18 and they have to go to be drafted to the Russian army, they go back to Kazakhstan, find a job there and stay there. There are many things. They get pluses there, minuses in different places and just to and fro. What I'm saying is, of course, they're frightened, and whatever Russia is doing, Russia is doing it using the leverages of power, making them doing it. And at this point, if Nazarbayev understands, if he joins this new union, the Eurasian Economic Union, the Ukrainian scenario is not possible. But, you know,
or is it more possible? I mean, or is it more possible?
Is it?
Think about it. Imagine. I mean, I know it sounds like a science fiction novel at this point, but imagine there is a true democratic revolution in Kazakhstan, right? Or Belarus, for that matter, which is even more of a science fiction novel, right? Imagine that happens. Is it easier for Putin to send his little green men in or out of the Eurasian Union? Probably in it, right? I'm not sure. It's like inoculation against a Ukrainian scenario, but nevertheless, and we were on a program last week about this, and we talked about this, and you very eloquently pointed out what a crafty statesman Nazarbayev is, and how good he is at whatever we think of him. We cannot deny his talent as a statesman. And right now, he seems to be doing his best to undermine this Eurasian Economic Union. Just a couple of points. I mean, the point in the agreement about including a Eurasian parliament or any kind of political body, Nazarbayev got that struck out of the agreement. That's going to be dealt with in annexes later, right? That's one. And suddenly, when did he start to care so much about Nagorno-Karabakh? I mean, the backstory here is Nazarbayev said Armenia, who is not a member yet but is planning to join, should not be able to join because of the conflict in Karabakh. Since when did Nazarbayev become he isn't. It's just an excuse what he said is he doesn't want Kazakhs to be sent to solve the problem in Karabakh if they're in the customs. He's just trying to scuttle this,
course,
in my opinion.
I share that opinion. He is a skillful man. He skillfully balances between centers of power and influence between West and East, between Russia and China, between Islamic world and the United States, let's say. And, of course, he uses any possibility to hinder the process of integration. Mm-hmm. Officially, he says, I am for the integration. Officially, he is, even yesterday he was presented, on Friday he was presented as a person who created this idea. But, in fact, there were many cases when he actually was using any excuse to prevent hinder the process of integration.
No, he's fine with the process of integration on paper. That's clear.
Yeah.
But he seems to not want it in reality,
no.
Or he's trying to water it down, scale it back. Natalia, what do you think? We talked about how the events in Ukraine have affected attitudes inside Ukraine. Do you see this having a kind of effect elsewhere in the ex-USSR?
There are two points that I would like to make in connection with Crimea. When we talk to the military specialists and security specialists, they all say that operation like in Crimea had to be in preparation for a long time. So it's not something you prepare for a week or 2 weeks or even several months. There are years that you need to think about this, to plan it ahead, and to know exactly how you're going to do this. And for the last 4 years, we had a very friendly regime in Kiev towards Moscow. We had the regime of Mr. Yanukovych. So that sends really a shivering signal to both Belarus and to Kazakhstan, meaning that there is no way you can be too friendly to Russia and not expect that at one point they will still use your weakness at a certain point. And there is a second thing, and it's a historical parallel that our correspondent and observer in Ukraine and a very good colleague, Vitaly Portnikov, made about Crimea. And he made this parallel with Stalin and Putin, that they both were considered something like gatherers of the lands when Stalin annexed the Baltic republics and Putin annexed Crimea. What happened then that Baltic republics had exactly the same status in the Soviet Union as all other republics, but they didn't have the same status in the minds of the West. So when they declared the independence, Moscow thought that maybe we didn't really need to keep them in the Union because they are really different. So we'll let them go. And that was not perceived the same way in the former Soviet Union republics, who saw them exactly the same way as Belarus, Kazakhstan or Ukraine. So if they could make themselves independent, then Ukraine could also make itself independent. And this is how the whole process started. So when and if Crimea is, with its very questionable status within the Russian Federation for the outside world, will be given to Ukraine back or will be, this status is going to be discussed because this is no way that the world is going to accept it the way that it is. That may start the whole process of disintegration of Russia because Crimea has exactly the same status within the Russian Federation as everyone else.
That's a very, I mean, in regathering the Russian, I mean, Putin is creating what they call in Russian "bratny rezultat." He could really speed up the disintegration of Russia. That's a very interesting point. One thing I wanted to ask you, Natalia, this because this is not the first time we've seen Russia use military force outside its borders since the breakup of the Soviet Union. The Georgian War of 2008 was that. Thinking back to that time, back to 2008, how did that affect people in Ukraine's attitudes? Did it scare people? Did it make people think we have to get away from Russia? We have to appease Russia. We don't want this to happen here. How did that happen there? Because that might give us a little bit of window into how some other countries are looking at the situation now.
Well, the reaction towards the fact was, of course, it dependent on who you talk to, because the majority of the population were buying into the Russian version of the story. They were watching the Russian television channels, and many Russian-speaking Ukrainian television channels which would reproduce the same story. But if you talk to the analysts and specialists in the expert community, they would say that inevitably Ukraine would be next if this is not stopped at this point. And of course, Putin was not stopped at this point. The West made some protests, but then business went back to normal as usual. So not that they would expect the same thing, but this was not excluded anymore.
Mm. America, what do you think? I mean, we seem to see this steady escalation going on here. I mean, we've had frozen conflicts like Transnistria, South Ossetia, Abkhazia. This escalates into the outright use of military force in Georgia in 2008. And now we got the annexation of, it's ratcheted up another notch, the annexation of the territory of another sovereign state. Where's this go now?
Well, this is a bit different than from what happened in Georgia, for instance. In the situation in Georgia, it was more complicated. In Kazakhstan, for instance, many people were not so clear, because as an ethnic minority of the former Soviet Union, even Kazakh nationalists were in a way perplexed, because Abkhaz, they're ethnically different than Georgia. Yeah. And this bigger brother, younger brother, smaller brother thing, was... With Ukraine, it's completely different.
Mm-hmm.
With Ukraine, we are seeing that, the Abkhazia and South Ossetia, they were not incorporated forcibly into Russian Federation. They are like independent states.
They're unrecognized.
Unrecognized, at least on paper. But there, in Crimea, it became part of Russia in just 24 hours. And this is what frightened everybody. If Crimea was even, everybody could condemn Russia, but Crimea is, let's say, as they first announced it, is an independent territory, not belonging to Ukraine, but having good relations with Russia or something like that, then it will be all again. They do, but Putin goes further. Putin now does stuff, and what is next? People are concerned.
Well, yeah, one has to wonder. One of the big differences I see, and I had this conversation with our Georgian service director, David Kakabadze, who I was hoping to have on with us today, but he was unable to come. But with the Georgian war, those of us that follow Russia closely, we saw what was happening. There was a provocation. Saakashvili reacted to the provocation, bang, and Putin's got his cause.
Yeah.
But not everybody, and even in the West, I mean, I remember conversations I had with very well-educated, well-informed Americans saying, well, this Saakashvili guy is a bit of a hothead. What was Putin going to do? But unless you really have an intricate knowledge and you really follow this stuff closely on a daily basis, and to see that for what it was at the time. And what David said to me is, now what the Ukraine thing is doing is, people are now, it's pretty clear what the Georgian thing, it was a dress rehearsal for this.
I agree.
So we do this, see this progression. It's unclear where it's going. But on the other hand, we have these mitigating factors. The countries like Kazakhstan and even Belarus are getting a little bit nervous about where Putin's going to take this. It's one thing to be a dictator that's pro-Moscow, and you, on one hand, you need that support to protect yourself from possibly a popular uprising in your own country. But on the other hand, you want to keep your sovereignty, right?
Yep.
These countries have more than 20 years of statehood. Yep. They've established their statehood. They're accustomed to their statehood, and they don't want to lose their statehood. This isn't like in the Soviet Union when Ukraine had how many years of independence between the breakup of the Russian Empire and the beginning of the Soviet Union? Just a couple of years.
Not a single one without war.
Right. And ditto for Belarus, ditto for Georgia. The Baltics had a little bit longer independence, but this time these countries have had 20-plus years of independence. This is a little bit tougher a project. Before we move on to the next section, I just wanted to ask just what you think. What's your gut feeling right now? It's a question we've raised throughout the program. Is this Eurasian Union going to be just another one of these organizations on paper, like the CIS, and or just an organization on paper, or is this going to be something different? Merkai, go ahead if you have your thoughts collected.
I think it will depend upon not only Putin, but Nazarbayev and Lukashenko. Nazarbayev is more subtle.
Mm-hmm.
He's more skillful. He's able to manipulate facts skillfully keeping balance and stuff. Even, you know, look, we see that in the UN General Assembly, Kazakhstan abstained.
Right.
In this situation, it's a big deal. But I mean, when they were voting about situation in Crimea to recognize the annexation or not, Armenia was frightened to.
Yeah. Armenia was remains frightened
to such an extent that they joined the club. I mean, there was only two, I would say, European countries, but countries of you which we know as part of, or even not if not politically, but geographically, Armenia and Belarus. But others were something like Venezuela, you know, others who supported it. And in situation with Kazakhstan, we see that how skillfully Nazarbayev is trying to avoid the real lose of independence or sovereignty of his country. For different reasons, of course, but that will depend if Lukashenko, if Sarkisyan and Atambayev, these two countries who want to join the
Kyrgyzstan
union,
and Armenia,
if they're on the same level, if they are, if not themselves, but if they have some kind of alliance within this group, within this bloc, and try to do something, then then probably, but. It's very hard to say now, but I think what Russia lacks is democracy. If Russia was an open and democratic country, the country around it would be more than happy to join it, to join any bloc.
Even the countries that aren't democratic, like Kazakhstan and Belarus?
Well, I would say if Russia is a democratic country, the countries around it
might be democratic as well.
Yeah.
That's an interesting point.
That's a drive. Yeah. I mean, Russia is more important in that terms for Kazakhstan and Belarus.
Mm-hmm. Even for dictatorial countries, it is easier to deal with the democratic country because it is predictable. Mm. So with Russia, it would be much easier for both Lukashenko and Nazarbayev to deal with Russia as a democracy than Russia as Russia as an authoritarian country, and getting even more so every day. I would like to continue this line of thought that Merhat started about the democracy, because with Ukraine and CIS when it started, and when Russia was still sort of trying the democratic way, it was already the first problems started when countries like Ukraine insisted that there would be some kind of a democratic process within the CIS. And when that was over in a few years, it was completely clear that this organization is not going to be organized according to the democratic principles. There was nothing else that Ukraine could do there anymore. And the same problem would, in my opinion, would arise in this Eurasian Union, because there would not be. It's clear that who is going to set the rules of the game, and who it's clear how the rules of the game are going to be set. So, what these countries like Belarus or Kazakhstan, even though Kazakhstan is an important, a big country, it will be extremely difficult for them to try to change the rules and to organize things according to their view, according to their interests, their national interests. And for Russia to have someone with their national interests in the union with Russia is something unimaginable.
Yeah. Now, my view is, even though I played the hymn of the Soviet Union at the outset of this podcast, my view is this is going to be an organization on paper. Without Ukraine, Kakoy Soyuz, really. Mm-hmm. And given Nazarbayev's craftiness as a statesman and Kazakhstan's rising power, it's going to be harder for Russia to dominate this the way it otherwise would. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion about Putin's Eurasian Union and its implications for the post-Soviet space, and take a closer look at how Putin has prepared the ground for the actions we're seeing today. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFURL. Joining me at the studio in Prague is Mirkat Shadabjan, a senior correspondent and analyst with RFURL's Central Newsroom and former director of our Kazakh service. And also joining us here in Prague is Natalia Chudakova, senior editor of RFURL's Ukrainian service and host of the program European Connect.
It's important to note that the transfer of certain authority from national bodies to the Union is causing absolutely no damage to the sovereignty of our countries. The mutual benefit of the integration process is already proving itself in practice. The economic cooperation of Russia, Belarus, and Kazakhstan is widening. The structure of trade is developing. The proportion of high technical goods is expanding in the general structure. And the competitive edge of our countries in the world economy is getting stronger.
Well, I'm sure even as Mr. Putin made that speech, he understood that there are more ways than one to damage a country's sovereignty. Back in 2012, Chatham House published an interesting briefing paper that argued that Putin was seeking to use corrupt business schemes to capture elites in former Soviet states and to make them compliant and servile through these business relationships. So I think this paper's there's a bit from this paper, the money quote, I call it, that's worth quoting directly. Quote, Putin used the carrot of corruption in conjunction with the stick of kompromat to establish patron-client political relationships. He's speaking about inside the Russian Federation. By broadening this approach to the corrupt transnational schemes that flowed seamlessly from Russia to the rest of the former Soviet space and ooze beyond it, Putin could expand his shadow influence beyond Russia's borders and develop a natural captured constituency beyond for maintaining a common Eurasian economic business space. Now, what is this report saying here? Put simply, Putin is trying to export the Russian model to the former Soviet space, in which domestically in Russia, he uses kompromat to basically keep the elite in line. Everybody can steal within limits, but everybody has kompromat on them. So therefore, anybody can be exposed and imprisoned at any time. And this is a very powerful tool of control that Putin very skillfully uses inside of Russia. If somebody gets in trouble for corruption, you have to know that that person misbehaved politically one way or the other. Now he appears to be trying to formalize this and expanding it to create what I call a corrupt economic union, where he can control the elites. It's kind of an anti-EU, right? It's an anti-EU. Instead of transparency, there's institutionalized corruption. Instead of competition, there's monopoly control. And instead of the rule of law, there is, quote, the carrot of corruption and the stick of kompromat. Everybody's corrupt, so everybody is vulnerable. Natalia, this strategy seems to have had mixed results in Ukraine. Part of the elite has certainly been corrupted. And we're not just talking about Yanukovych here. Even part of the so-called European elite, pro-European elite's been corrupted. And I think a lot of that was behind Mr. Yanukovych flipping and flopping before he was deciding whether to sign an association agreement with the European Union or join the Eurasian Economic Union. But on the other hand, the majority of the population has pretty much made up its mind that it wants no part of this and has rejected this model and says it wants a different kind of leadership. How do you see this playing out? I mean, because Putin has managed to corrupt a lot of the Ukrainian elite, and a lot of them are vulnerable even now.
Yes, and that's a big problem now for the Ukrainian state because the organizing principle was corruption. So there were no state interests, there were no state institutions that would be free of corruption. So everything was based on corruption. Well, it's to a certain extent, of course, if it were not for Russia, the extent of corruption wouldn't be so high, so big. But I should say that it's not only in Ukraine that you mentioned the European Union. He uses the same principle and largely to the same results as in Ukraine, also in the European Union countries, and even with big countries like Germany, like Italy, like Great Britain. He uses the high state figures and corrupts them. You just mention Mr. Schröder, who went to work for Mr. Putin after he
left the chancellorship.
Yes, after after he stopped being a German chancellor, or Mr. Berlusconi, who had a very close relationship with Putin, and a number of British ministers. So there is a whole mechanism of using corruption as an organizing principle and as a principle of fostering the Russian interests. And also, because Russia as an economy is not very much influential, because the Russian economy compared to the European economy is much, much smaller, but the influence that Russian politicians can wage over the European this principle of making decisions, decision-making principles, is much, much higher because of that, because they can influence people directly, the politicians directly, and not only the center-right politicians, but also the far-right and far-left,
who were the main
friends of Putin in the European Union. So taking these pieces of puzzle together, you can see that his influence over the European Union is much, much bigger than one could have thought about judging by this level of bilateral relations and trade relations, economic relations.
Although one has to wonder if the events in Ukraine now have basically woken up a critical mass of the European elite, because you're right. He's used these corrupt schemes inside the former Soviet Union to kind of capture elites and to control and eventually reestablish the empire. Possibly, he's used it in the European Union as a tool of influence to get Europe to basically not bother him. Essentially.
Not only that, because there are many decisions that are important in the European Union, like these gas deals.
Pipelines, yeah.
You see that by playing one against the other, he can get a better price, better conditions, and things like that. So his worst horror is probably seeing European Union speaking with one voice in issues like that, and by trying and dividing and ruling the situation like this, he can extract the biggest profits for himself and for his company.
Yeah. Mirkat, how would you assess the success or failure? And we seem to agree that this is the strategy. I really do think Chatham House hit it on the head with this briefing. How would you assess the success and failure of this strategy in the former Soviet space? I mean, you watch Central Asia pretty closely. You watch the Caucasus pretty closely.
This is a model for all the countries there. Yeah. Especially for Kazakhstan. One of the closest associates of Nazarbayev today is Tony Blair. He is on his paycheck. And Tony Blair, in a way, helps Nazarbayev to improve his image abroad. Mm. He, among his other supporters, is, I don't remember his first name, the writer Aitken in the UK, who wrote several books about him, I think at least two, in English. Nazarbayev pays hundreds of thousands of dollars to different media outlets abroad to improve his image and stuff. And this is not only normal procedure for Putin. In Ukraine, I'm sure the system during Yanukovych and before that was the same. The problem here is this is... we're talking about the countries which used to be part of the Soviet Union. It was the KGB method.
Yeah.
And Putin is a former KGB officer. It's not only about today's situation. I'm sure he has a lot of, in his files, information about Nazarbayev.
Right. Well, that's what I'm driving. To what extent has he captured elites in places like Kazakhstan? Because this is all about what we call elite capture, basically. You lure somebody in with a corrupt business scheme, and then that person is yours to use. Right? Because that person doesn't want to be exposed.
But we have the situation when some people like Nazarbayev have money to get his, Putin's problems too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're talking
about...
So it's
the war of kompromat between...
Yes, and I don't exclude, because we do not have to underestimate the wealth of Nazarbayev and his strength of his... Secret services, what happened recently in Malta, and his people infiltrate many structures in Europe. Kazakhstan's elite interests were protected by many European officials on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. So, yes.
So two can play at this game,
yeah,
is what you're like, saying.
I'm sure there will be more if, you know, Kazakhstan is a country which sits, it has 24, we're talking about oil and gas, but, you know, Kazakhstan has all the chemicals, I mean, and non-ferrous metals possible and imaginable and non-imaginable in his possession. They're selling everything, you know. We're talking about the country of 17 million people. Only it's like one Moscow with all the suburbs,
right?
And they have zinc,
not a lot of land and lot of natural resources.
Lead, zinc, molybdenum, whatever you call it, they produce it. This is the only country in Asia which produces wheat and sells it abroad on a huge amounts for money. The elite is very rich, mm-hmm. and they are able to stand against oligarchs in Russia.
That's interesting, because one of the ways I was looking at this is it's almost like if the little green men represented a new form of warfare, and this is right out of the KGB playbook. And what we can't forget is that, you know, in the Soviet times, the KGB was under the control of the party. Right now, they're not under the control of anybody. It's you know, Siovlas Lubyanka. You know, Lubyanka is in control. If the little green men are a new form of warfare, what we're seeing now might be a new form of empire. You don't need to formally recreate the Soviet Union or any union. As long as you capture elites across the former Soviet space, you get the de facto Soviet Union, basically. And I'm wondering if this might be where we're going. Mirka, you're suggesting that others can play this game too, and maybe Kazakhstan can play it just as well as Russia. And that's a very interesting thing to watch, and something that merits watching. Ukraine's trying to get out of this thing. but
I'm afraid that compromise doesn't work as well when you don't control the mass media. And it's only works well when you can control the minds of the people who are going to be the consumers of mm-hmm. that message. And I'm not sure that Kazakhstan wages the same kind of influence in Russian media
as the Russian media wages inside of Kazakhstan.
Exactly.
Yeah, I agree with that. But what I'm talking about is talks, negotiations, intrigues within elites,
right.
When they bargain, when they want to, you know, they...
No, this is going to make it a little bit tougher for Putin, but I do think he's very, I reluctantly say the word cleverly and craftily, trying to create a different kind of an empire here.
Yeah.
Before we wrap up, we just got a couple of minutes. What are your thoughts on that, Natalia? I mean, do you see this kind of as a new form of empire? And Ukraine clearly wants to get itself the hell out of it.
Well, definitely Ukraine wants to get out of it as soon as possible, but it's while it's more difficult now with the undercover war that Russia wages on Ukraine in eastern parts of Ukraine. But I think it's a warning signal for everyone else of having very close and very friendly relations with Russia, that nothing protects you from the rage of Putin when you misbehave. And this is what happened in Ukraine. But also in Ukraine, you had a much more advanced population in terms of democratic values and the media, which you do not have this to the same extent in Belarus and in Kazakhstan. So I think their elites are much more vulnerable in that sense, that their people, their population is not going to defend them. They're not going to defend the state to that extent mm-hmm. as Ukrainians were prepared to defend the mm-hmm. independence of their state.
Mm, that's an interesting point. It's interesting how and why Ukraine developed that way, because it's almost like Russia and Ukraine are separated at birth in a lot of ways. If you go back to 1991, if you didn't have the Putinism come in, Russia probably would be pretty close to where Ukraine is now. You have this oligarchy, but you had pluralism, kind of like you had in Russia in the 90s, but it developed and the population grew and became a civil society emerged. this didn't happen as quickly in Russia. It happened much quicker in Ukraine. But Ukraine, to me, represents where Russia should be right now.
The problem was with Russia, I think, from the start, was the national consensus of what things you have a national consensus. And in Russia, it was much more easier to organize people around the greatness Russia and the empire and the ideas like that. So it was much more difficult to find an alternative way, a more democratic kind of way.
Yeah. Mirkat, last word to you before we wrap up.
I think everything in the end of the day will depend upon the people. The thing is that Ukrainians travel to Europe much more frequently. They are close. In Russia, only 10 or 11% of population have foreign passports or travel documents. Mm-hmm. And those people, the majority of them, go once a year to Turkey or Egypt. This is it.
Yeah.
In Ukraine, it's completely different. We see Ukrainians here studying at the universities, traveling without visas, and they see what they're fighting for. They're fighting for European values.
Yeah.
It's different. Whatever Putin is doing, as soon as Russians in big numbers, in percent, I mean,
travel
abroad, and young people will get an idea that if you're a citizen of the European Union, you can get education at the university, or your children can get education in UK universities, in Germany, in France, you can have a job there. Then as soon as they understand what Ukrainians are fighting for, then things are going to be changed.
Yeah, no, this illustrates that at the end of the day, no matter how much they scheme in Moscow, at the end of the day, the reality on the ground favors the transparent EU against this corrupt economic space. But it might take a while before we can get to that place. And on that note, we'll wrap up. That, unfortunately, is all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me in the studio here in Prague is Mirkat Shudupshan, a senior correspondent and analyst with RFERL's Central Newsroom and former director of our Kazakh service. Also joining me here in Prague has been Natalia Chudikova, senior editor of RFERL's Ukrainian service and host of the program European Connect. Thank you to both of my colleagues for an enlightening and fascinating discussion.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And I'd also like to thank my brilliant, patient, and overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally awesome Twitter feed Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.